We're approaching the Feast of Trumpets, as you know, and that's coming up very shortly. And at the same time, we are approaching the last two of the seven trumpets in our Bible study on the book of Revelation. So we're coming into some time of trumpets here. And the sixth and seventh trumpet, the last two, reveal the events leading up to the return of Jesus Christ to the earth. And just before the fall holy days seems a good time to review other sections that we need to cover as part of our Revelation series that help provide the framework to understand these end time events. There are two prophetic books in the Bible which, when properly understood, provide a step-by-step sequence of the events that lead up to Christ's return. And those two books are Daniel and Revelation. Daniel gives more information, more detail on the ancient kingdoms, and Revelation gives more detail on the more modern kingdoms, or even the ones that is still to come. And when we see how they fit together, Daniel has more detail in the past and gets less as you go forward. Revelation has less detail in the past and gets more as you go forward. When we see how they fit together, and including Christ's prophecy on the Mount Olivet, we can see more clearly the whole picture. The other prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and others, have prophecies that don't always follow in chronological order. They'll talk about one event, and then they'll talk about a different event. And you don't know quite where you are with those. But with Daniel and Revelation, you can put them together, and then these other ones fall into place. And you can begin to put them together and see the whole picture. Daniel and Revelation provide the sequence. The others provide the detail that can be understood by using the sequence of events found in Daniel and Revelation. And there's one chapter in particular that provides an overview of Bible prophecy regarding these end time events. And it's the one that God gave first, and that's Daniel chapter 2. Daniel, the second chapter. Let's go to the book of Daniel. And we will take a look at the beginning of the chapter of the book at chapter 1 and verse 1. In the year of the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Aspenaz, the master of these eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles. Now, he was to bring them, and actually the Sonsino, the Jewish commentary, says, these are not three groups. This is one group described in three ways, according to the Sonsino. So they bring of the children of Israel, of the king's descendants, and the nobles, the very best of the king's descendants. They were spared because they were educated and wise. He said, then the king instructed Aspenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says the children there, or the young men, that would indicate somewhere 12 to 14 years old. The Sonsino commentary says about 15, so they're pretty much in agreement there. Now, notice they were going to take the children of the king. I'd like you to keep your finger there, if you would, and go to 2 Kings. 2 Kings. In chapter 20. 2 Kings, chapter 20. And we'll go to where Isaiah has a talk with Hezekiah. Hezekiah had visitors from Babylon, and he unwisely showed them everything. And in 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 14, then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and said to him, what did these men say, and from where did they come to you? So Hezekiah said, they came from a far country, from Babylon. And he said, What have they seen in your house? So Hezekiah answered, they have seen all that's in my house. There's nothing among my treasures that I have not shown them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and what your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And they shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget, and they will be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Isn't that a startling thing? So Hezekiah had a surprising response. So Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good. For he said, will there not be peace and truth, at least in my days? I'll be okay. That's kind of an unpleasant thought, isn't it? But he was looking at it that way. Remember when he was going to die, he prayed God and God changed his mind. Why didn't he do the same thing? I don't know. Anyway, the prophecy was there. So he said, the king instructed Aphanaz, back in Daniel chapter 1, verse 3, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the young nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had the ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. Now these were to be exceptional people. And they were going to be brought in there that they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. Notice, not the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. Soncino says, the language of the populace was Aramaic. Chaldean was the language of the wise men, of the learned class. And he gives a reference. The mastery of which required great application and concentrated mental effort, according to one previous commentator among the Jewish scholars. So they were to be very talented young men, and they had ability to learn. Their lives were saved, and they were spared and given this opportunity because they were bright, and they had discipline, and they were knowledgeable. He says in verse 5, and the king appointed them for a daily provision from the king's delicacy and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. He wanted them to be counselors, advisors, educated people, to bring in the knowledge of the children of Israel, teach them the knowledge of the Babylonians, and have wise counselors, people of ability in his kingdom, to be able to serve at various places. They had 3 years of training. Verse 6, now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Daniel means God's prince. Well, I better read the next verse too. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He renamed them. One of the things that kings would do to show their power and their ability of these new servants was to change, to give them new names. God did that with a couple of his servants too. He gave Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and Hananiah Shadrach, and Mishael Meshach, and Azariah. Daniel means God's prince or judge. Belshazzar means Bel, B-E-L, prince. Hananiah, according to various ones, has to do with the mercy of Yahweh, the mercy of Jehovah. Shadrach, he was renamed. Hananiah was previously mercy of Yahweh. He was changed and inspired or illuminated by the sun god, Shadrach. Mishael means who is like God, was changed to Meshach, who was like Bel. And Azariah, Jehovah will help, was changed to Abednego, servant of Nebo. J.F.M.B. says, Abednego, that is, servant of the shining fire. Thus, instead of to Jehovah, these servants were dedicated by the heathen to their four leading gods, Bel, the chief god, the sun god, earth god, and fire god. To the last of the three, the fire god, the three youths were consigned when they refused to worship the golden image. The Chaldee version translates Lucifer in Isaiah 14:12. This is the Chaldean version. Lucifer in Isaiah 14:12 to Nogea, the same as Nego. The names of thus onset are significant of the seeming triumph but sure downfall of the heathen powers before Jehovah and his people. They were going to be renamed again. Back in down in verse 17, as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge. God gave them extra ability, as he has with various people down through the ages. God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature, not just Chaldean, in all literature. And wisdom, what a gift, the gift of wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And the way they look at this is he gave them all knowledge and skill in literature and wisdom, but Daniel had the additional benefit of having understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, verse 18, when the king had said they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. They had their 3 years training. Then the king interviewed them, and among them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. They were given principal responsibilities. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, both from an Israelite point of view and from a Babylonian point of view or a Chaldean point of view. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Babylon was known for astronomy, for architecture, for linguistics, for agriculture, for meteorology, for agronomy, and much more. It was a knowledge center. And Daniel was at the center of the knowledge center, and so were his friends. God had placed them strategically for his great purpose. More about that in a minute. Now we get to Daniel 2. And in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave a commandment to the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, and these are different levels divisions within their intelligentsia, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came before the king, and the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, and from verse 4 up to now, the original is in Hebrew. From verse 4 till the end of chapter 7, it is all written in Aramaic, the book of Daniel. And we're going to come into this prophecy, and you know, I think most of us know some of the background that we're going to go into, but let me just make this point first. This is probably the best known prophecy in the Old Testament. There may be others, but it's among the best known. All Bible commentaries that I know of identify the four world-ruling kingdoms that are prophesied to come in this chapter. Now, that's an astonishing thing. You seldom get everybody agreeing on anything. And this is one they agree on. They all say four kingdoms that are going to be described are Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Greek, and then the Roman. They all say that. In verse 31 says, "The world power in its totality appears as a colossal human form, Babylon the head of gold, Medo-Persia the breast, and two arms of silver, Greco-Macedonia, the belly, and two thighs of brass, and Rome with its Germano-Slavonic offshoots, the legs of iron and the feet of iron." Adam Clark agrees with that. The NIV Study Bible, Harry Myers, agrees with that. The Wycliffe Bible Commentary agrees with that. Even the Sonsino Jewish Commentary agrees with that. Kyle and DeLeach identify the first three and only hint at Rome being the fourth. But they provide no other identification for the fourth. But they all have a kink in their understanding that throws them off. They're all unable to distinguish between the first coming of Christ and his second coming. They struggle with his relationship with the Roman Empire at his first coming and his relationship with it at his second coming. They're quite different relations with the Roman Empire between his first coming and his second coming. Now, let's get back to our story here. And the king said to them, I've had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. Then the Chaldean spoke to the king in Aramaic. O king, live forever, typical greeting. Tell your servants the dream, and we'll give you the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you will not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. You don't want to serve in this court and fall out of favor. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. They answered again, and they said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you will gain time, because you see that my decision is firm. You know I meant what I said. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the time has changed. He got sick of these people. He got tired of them because he no longer had confidence in them. And if they could tell him the dream, then presumably his interpretation would be right. If they couldn't tell him what it was, then he didn't have any confidence in their interpretation. Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there's not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such a thing of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not in flesh. They just set themselves up. Because if there's only God can tell the dream, when he did, they had to say, well, this had to come from God. They really just set themselves up. Verse 11 again. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious, and gave the command to destroy all the wise men, wipe them all out, he said. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. As I say, these guys were really out of favor. All right, verse 14. Then with counsel and wisdom, remember God had given Daniel wisdom and understanding. Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. Arioch, according to the Sonsino commentary, means Eri, E-R-I, dash Aku, A-K-U, servant of the moon god. Isn't it interesting? They still worship the moon god over there? Arioch, captain of the king's guard, is literally chief of the slaughterers, or we'd say chief executioner. I mean, imagine having a chief slaughterer. That means there are others. Okay, so then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch. This guy is sent to kill him, and Daniel has a conversation with him. Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch explained or made the decision known to Daniel. He explained the circumstance. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time. And they're not sure whether this was directly to the king. He did have access to the king, but to give him time that he might tell the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house, verse 17. And he made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Now, if you're ever in trouble, it'd be great if your name is God's judge or God is my judge, to have a guy named Hananiah, mercy of Yahweh. That would be a nice guy to have with you. And it'd be good to say, who is like God, Mishael, and Azariah, YHVH will help. Yahweh will help. Those are the guys you want with you, praying about that in that particular spot. He said, then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven. And here's the phrase, God of heaven. It's used 8 times in Daniel, and you'll see it several times in chapter 2. That the God of heaven, the one who dwells in heaven, concerning this secret, so Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men in Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. Notice that? He gives wisdom to the wise. You think, well, they don't need it. Oh, yes, they do. They know they need it, and they ask for it, and that's wise. And knowledge to understanding. Understanding and knowledge go together. When you understand something, you can learn it. You can learn greater. And knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. Can you imagine this young Jewish boy of the king's son who apparently was made a eunuch? We don't ever read of a Mrs. Daniel. In Babylon, calling to his father's God in gratitude. It must have been very, very moving. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might. And how now he knew he was in a strong position. He was already in a strong position, and now it's going to be even stronger. And have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. That's a little cheeky, wasn't it? Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king. He didn't think he liked the job he was given. And said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives. It sounds like he's taking credit for it here now a little bit. Maybe he's not. I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king his interpretation. He had confidence that Daniel would do it. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? There's an open question. Daniel did not say yes. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven. Now here again, the God of heaven. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets and has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. What's going to happen in the latter days? Now, he's going to jump all the way down the centuries and to the understanding there. Nebuchadnezzar had lost confidence in the Babylonian gods, and God was about to show that he is God. And as I said, Daniel was not in a position of strength. Only God, even the Babylonians acknowledged that, could reveal the dream. And the Babylonian gods were false gods. If God knows the dream, then you know he knows the interpretation. And clearly, Daniel is his servant. Now, so God, Daniel gives God the credit. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secret, and he's made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. This prophecy will go from the first world-ruling empire of Babylon to the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth. These are Gentiles. Not Israelite kingdoms. Literally, it describes in the broadest sense the times of the Gentiles, in the broadest sense. The end when Jesus Christ returns and destroys all the armies gathered around Jerusalem. Daniel 7, which we'll get to one of these days, describes the same kingdoms as a lion, a bear, a leopard, and one that's indescribable. But notice they were all wild in nature, fierce. Now, let's go on then. He said in verse 29, Well, let's see. But there's a God in heaven who reveals secrets, has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. God showed it to Nebuchadnezzar. God revealed his plan to the leader of this empire. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. I have a feeling that he would have his full intention right there. Now, what you dreamed, King, was this. Wouldn't you think he'd be right there? But as for me, verse 30, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living. But for our sakes, who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. Notice what he said. The first reason God did it, he gave two reasons, to benefit Daniel and his friends. God used the situation to place them beyond reach of those who would seek to harm them. Later, they would try very hard to get Daniel. You remember the story of the lion's den, and that Daniel wouldn't bow down to the idol. And that ordeal, even that, would only put Daniel in an even stronger position. Brethren, let me give you a little tip. Never conspire against God's servants. Don't do it. Come to think of it, brethren never would. And to inform King Nebuchadnezzar of the thoughts of his heart. What must Nebuchadnezzar, I can only imagine what Nebuchadnezzar was thinking then. He's like, all right, now I'm going to tell you. And he'd just be glued to him. Verse 31. You, O king, were watching, and behold a great image. The great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. And the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Summed up the verse, just a few verses, summed up the whole dream. Now you can be sure he really had Nebuchadnezzar's attention. He told him what the dream was. Only God could reveal that. Verse 36. This is the interpretation. This is the dream. Now we'll tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven, there's that title again, has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Now God, he's telling Nebuchadnezzar that it was God who gave him the kingdom, not Nebuchadnezzar's great wisdom and skill. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Now that'd be good news, wouldn't it? Head of gold would mean, of the things that are being described here, is the most valuable. Gold's the most valuable. It's also the most beautiful. It's the heaviest. But it's the softest. Verse 39. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. Then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the earth. And a fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Well, I'll just stop with verse 39. Let me do that one. Two world-ruling empires. I should mention the Babylonian Empire is thought to have reigned from 625 B.C. to 539, a period of 86 years. Now, the chest and arms of silver, Medo-Persian Empire, that is said to have gone from 558 to 330 B.C., a period of about 228 years. Notice silver is a bit less valuable, a bit less beautiful, a bit less heavy, and yet it's a little harder. The belly and thighs of bronze is thought to be is generally described as the Greco-Macedonian Empire that began in 33 BC. Once again, a bit less valuable, less beautiful, less heavy, but harder. And this kingdom is thought to have lasted about 300 years. Alexander didn't last 300 years, but apparently the historians put the kingdom lasting about 300 years. Now in verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Iron is the strongest of them all, the hardest, and also the least valuable of those metals. Winston Churchill, in his history of the English-speaking people, makes the point, of all metals for crashing skulls, iron is the best. He had a way of writing things. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, inasmuch as the iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. It'll just stomp all the others. Where it was a very powerful one. This kingdom lasted, the Roman Empire is thought to have lasted from 36 BC to 476, about 400 years and counting, because it comes back. And that's where people have their trouble. Notice verse 41. Whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. It will have as a part of itself is division. Yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with the ceramic clay. And the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. You can't mix those two. Now, as I said, but Daniel in this description did not describe the legs of iron. He described the feet. Notice in verse 33 again, it's legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So understanding this helps avoid the error many make. The legs of iron were not mingled with clay. The original Roman Empire was all iron. It was brutal, ruthless empire. And the two legs imply in a division, the fact that there are two legs. The one head has a unity, shoulders and all that, but the two legs imply a division of some kind. Many believe it's east and west, and that's probably correct, and there are probably other answers to that as well. But the final resurrection or restoration is described as mixed, iron and clay mixed together, unsuccessfully. It says, and the toes and feet. Well, let's go back to verse 40. When you saw the feet, he didn't describe the legs. When you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay, partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with the ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And you saw, as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Now, the final resurrection will have this combination of clay and iron, and it's even further divided. The two legs are divided, and now it's further divided into five toes each. And it's so the division there is into 10 kings represented, which we'll see in other chapters as we go through them. So God is showing the final kingdom is seriously divided. First two legs, then split into 10 distinct toes. And the toes were of iron and clay, which is unstable. If your feet are unstable, the whole thing is unstable. You won't be standing very long. And it's about to get worse. You see what Daniel's describing to, or what God's describing through Daniel to King Nebuchadnezzar, is this kingdom looks great. You got this head of gold, oh, it's beautiful, but down here where it stands, it's unstable. Now, verse 44. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven, there's that title again, will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. The Babylonian Empire was left to the Medo-Persian people. The Medo-Persian people was left to the Greek, Greco-Macedonian. The Greco-Macedonian was turned over to the Romans. But this one's not going to be left to other people. in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And it says, never be destroyed. Many Bible scholars go wrong here. They think Jesus Christ set up the kingdom of heaven when he first came. His first coming was to establish the church, not to intervene in the affairs of men. And this time, he's definitely going to intervene in the affairs of men, in the governance of it. His second coming, he will come and involve government. He'll be King of Kings and Lord of Lords, but he didn't come that way the first time, or at least in that role. This verse, verse 44, describes Christ's second coming. And as I said, it says they won't be left to another people. The Catholic Church says the Pope is the vicar of Christ, that Christ turned the kingdom over to him. Well, if Jesus set up the kingdom and turned it over to somebody else, then he left it to other people. And it isn't the kingdom described in Daniel 2, verse 44. Once the kingdom of God is established on earth, it will remain forever. Never again will there be a change of kingdom or leadership. And there's another point to that. He said, and it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. These kingdoms still have some influence today, believe it or not. Babylon, the original one, had a religion. And if you keep your finger there, let's go to Revelation 17. Revelation 17. In verse 1, Revelation 17 and verse 1, then one of the seven angels, which had the seven bowls, came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. We will go through this in more detail, but this is a great harlot, the opposite of the faithful church. Harlot is an unfaithful representation. Who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk by the wine of her fornication. We'll explain all that. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The picture is of a woman riding a beast. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written. God names things what they are. Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abomination of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and of the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. He was really astonished by it. But the religion at the end of the age is the same one that the Babylonians, it's called the Babylonian mystery religion, that has been around all that time. It's the same one. It's got different names. It's got names of blasphemy connected with it. But it is the same one that came from Babylon. Interestingly, in Medo-Persian, they excelled in military strategy and tactics. Perhaps they're still around, their tactics that are there. In the Greek, they were the center of learning and culture and education and even democracy. And it's still today considered the ancient, you know, it wasn't many years ago that all British people had to learn Greek and Latin, or educated one, to be able to understand the classics and the educational things and the foundation of our society and the foundation of much of our thinking that takes place even today. And Roman, with law and government. Many things come from Latin. The word Congress comes from Latin. The word Senate comes from Latin. The word President comes from Latin. And even legislation all had to do with the ways that were there. You go back and you start studying our law, and you're going to go back to Rome in many cases, and Roman law and how it works. When I was pastor of New York City, we had a summer club. The kids had time to be able to do things. We had a summer club in the early 80s. And we went over these chapters, as a matter of thing, just to explain to the young people. And we had a young man from the Bronx. He was still in high school. And he gave a speech. astonished us all. He said he noticed symbolisms of the various leaders also pointed to their weaknesses. He said Nebuchadnezzar, he felt, was heady. Go along with that. He was kind of a proud individual. The Medo-Persians, the arms and the shoulders, the weakness there is you can get muscle bound, so it doesn't quite work like it used to. It might be very strong, but it gets muscle bound, it's no good. He covered Alexander quickly, but he said Alexander's problems were his belly and his thighs. In Rome, he pointed out, the two legs were divided between East and West, church and state. You know, the Vatican is both a state and a church. It's both. Iron and clay. Division is the hallmark of the Roman Empire. They're always struggling with unity. And right now, we have a system that's got certain roots back there, and boy, do we have trouble with unity, and it's getting worse. When Christ returns, he will fight the Roman armies whose religion is actually an updated version of the Babylonian mystery religion. Okay, back to Daniel chapter 2, verse 44. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Once established, it's never removed or changed. Each one of the four empires lasted longer than the previous one. This one's going to last forever. It shall stand forever when it's established. Verse 45. Inasmuch as you saw the stone that was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. Who's the gold? The guy who's hearing it. The great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. This is the dream is certain, and its interpretation sure. Now the stone broke in pieces, all of it. I'd like you to notice 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. Many commentaries will point to these verses. I want to show you another one that I didn't see anybody else point to. Maybe they did. Maybe I missed it. But here's one that they often point to. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 6 to 8. Peter writing said, therefore, it's also contained in Scripture, behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he who believes on him will by no means be put to shame. He won't be embarrassed. Those who trust in that chief cornerstone won't be embarrassed. Therefore, to you who believe, Peter says, he is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone, and this is the word stone, which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. The builders among the children of Israel rejected the chief cornerstone. But he became the chief cornerstone. And, verse 8, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. They stumbled being disobedient to the word to which they were also appointed. Being disobedient to the word means you don't recognize, you'll stumble when the cornerstone, stone, or rock of offense. I was thinking about that, rock of offense. We normally think of that, and it has to do with people stumbling or being upset. But if you look at it another way, how about rock of offense? You get that feeling back in Daniel 2, rock of offense. Let me show you Matthew 21. Here's Jesus talking to the religious leaders who rejected him, still do. Matthew chapter 21. And he has a parable there about the vineyard. And you know the parable, I presume. He asked them to comment, and they do. And he says in verse 42, verse 41, then they said to him, he will destroy those wicked men miserably and leave his vineyard to other vine dressers who will render to him the fruits in their season. Jesus said to them, have you never read in the scriptures the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone? This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Now notice the next words. Therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a nation bearing the fruits of it. The next verse is even more startling. And whoever falls on this stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it will grind him to powder. Now, when I was in Sunday school, when I was a kid, they never covered this verse. At least I can't remember ever talking about Jesus saying that if he falls on something, it's going to grind him to powder till it like doesn't exist. But that's exactly the image of Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44 and 45. It says, inasmuch as you saw the stone, which was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the clay, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. This is the dream. Now, he said, he grinded the powder. That's exactly what Daniel revealed to Nebuchadnezzar. Your kingdom, what he said to Nebuchadnezzar, your kingdom will be followed by three succeeding kingdoms led by different people. Eventually, God will smash the final divided and unstable kingdom and will turn it to powder or chaff. And the whole structure will disappear as if it's never existed. As I said, when I was in Sunday school, nobody ever covered that. Daniel 2, verse 35, just to rehearse the dream itself, he said, then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them. You can't, wind doesn't blow gold, but it becomes pulverized. And the wind carried them away like there was no trace of them found. No trace of the Babylonian Empire. No trace of the Medo-Persian Empire. No trace of the Greco or the Roman empires. Nothing. No trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. God's servant Isaiah said, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Completely and totally. Now imagine what Nebuchadnezzar was thinking about at this point. He was totally astonished. He was told his dream, which can't be done by humans, and he was told its meaning. He must have been utterly dumbfounded. Notice verse 46. Daniel concludes, the dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel. All of a sudden, he decides that Daniel is so wise, he's going to bow down to him. And commanded that they should bring an offering and incense to him. Daniel's having incense burned to him. It's kind of hard to stop the king. King, I really wish, would you mind, sir, if... It's just astonishing. The king answered Daniel and said, truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, chief administrator over all the wise men. He's the top wise man. And Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. He was right there at the gate of the king. Now, it's an amazing thing. God made himself known to the king of Babylon and told him what was going to happen from that time until the latter days, as he says in chapter 2 and verse 28. And Big Neb was so impressed that he bowed down to Daniel with an offering and incense. Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged God as the God of gods. I'm afraid we humans, though, we don't last too long. The next chapter, he makes an image of gold and wants everybody to worship it. So he kind of lost his zeal kind of quickly there. Maybe he wasn't the sharpest pencil in the deck or in the bunch. But Daniel was given high office in Babylon, and he was able to benefit many people in that exalted position. One of the things he could do was preserve all the Bible during the Babylonian captivity. He could preserve all the history, whatever books there were that he had of the children of Israel, and other literature. He could take care of that and be in charge of knowledge and literature so that nobody could move against him. I mentioned the trial later on, but it ends up strengthening him. Now, there's more detail given of this in Daniel chapter 7 and Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. We'll cover those as part of our study of the book of Revelation. But the prophecy of Daniel 2 can stand alone. We can learn from that one all by itself. And of course, the others are complementary. And as Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, the dream is certain and its interpretation is sure.